Our New Testament reading this morning is from Mark, chapter 4, verses 1 to 9, the parable of the sower. If you'd like to follow along, you'll find it on page 38 of your New Testament. Again, he began to teach beside the lake. Such a very large crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat on the lake and sat there while the whole crowd was beside the lake on the land. He began to teach them many things in parables, and in his teaching he said to them, "Listen, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seed fell on the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Other seed fell on rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and it sprang up quickly, since it had no depth of soil. And when the sun rose, it was scorched, and since it had no root, it withered away. Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. Other seed fell into good soil and brought forth grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30, 60, and 100-fold. And he said, "Let anyone with ears to hear listen." This is today's New Testament reading.
Years ago, I attended a workshop on conflict management in the church. I worked on a committee of the presbytery that dealt with churches in conflict and in difficult transitions. And the leader, the consultant who led this workshop, had made a whole career out of working with churches in conflict. And there was never any shortage of work for him. And he said one of the really interesting parts of his work was to get to hear the final sermons of pastors who were leaving their churches under pressure. He said someday he's going to publish a book of final sermons, these sort of parting shots that pastors took as they headed off, hopefully to greener pastures somewhere. And as I look at my last few sermons here at Montclair, I've been asking myself that same question, not what parting shots do I want to take, but what do I want to say before I go? And I've talked some about things that I've learned here in these 12 years about myself and about leadership and about forgiveness. There are things that I want to affirm about this church in the weeks to come, about this church's values and spirit and sense of community. But I was thinking about, well, this Sunday, what do I want to do this Sunday? What do I want to talk about? And you know what I really want to talk about is God. So that's the title. Kim said, "I like the title of your sermon, very terse." So, I couldn't think of what else to call it. But it might seem kind of obvious that we talk about God in church, you know, that generally that's the topic, you know, explicitly or implicitly every Sunday. But that's not necessarily the case. I know that this church has the tradition that a lot of progressive churches have, which was in the 60s, a lot of the progressive churches, especially in urban areas, started breaking away from tradition, from the empty traditions of the church of the 50s that were really reinforcing the status quo and now trying to be, seeking ways to be the countercultural church, the church that explored new use of language and new rituals or no rituals whatsoever. And the part of the purpose of that was to try to remedy in the life of the congregation the bad theology of the past, that people felt there had been an overemphasis on guilt and sin, especially personal sin, especially sex and the human body as a bad thing, and the repression of women and all the things that had sort of piled up as the church sought to be the reinforcer of the status quo of the culture. So what happened in the progressive churches that sought to be countercultural was that they reflected what was going on in the counterculture of society. A casting off of old repressive ways, casting off of guilt and shame and conformity. And so in the church there was this movement to actively and consciously cleanse the church of bad theology and empty ritual and to replace it with life-affirming language, creative worship practices. And you could see this going on in churches all across the nation, or bringing guitars in and not playing the pipe organ anymore, or having helium balloons on Pentecost or on Easter, or taking the militaristic metaphors and imagery out of the hymns and the prayers. Onward, Christian soldiers marching as to war sort of fell out of common use in those churches in the 60s. Crosses. I remember one church in Tiburon, they took the cross down and put up a butterfly to have a more positive and less sort of guilt-inducing image up there. And, you know, there were some excesses, but the impulse was good, and they were wonderful times. That was when I first started going to church as a teenager. They were socially engaged, and the worship and the activities of the church were relevant to people's daily lives. And in looking back, some people have written studies on some of the changes that happened, and that at that point in time, in the early 60s, early to mid-60s, Lauren Mead has written a wonderful book called The Once and Future Church, where he talks about the surrounding society as Christendom. That in the U.S., in those couple of decades, it was the society was generally Christian. You sang Christmas carols in the public schools. There was a nativity scene on the lawn of the city hall. If you said something like, "This person has the patience of Job," most of the people knew what you were talking about, got the metaphor. So the job of the church up until that time was really to reinforce the Christendom of society, and didn't have to do very much work to just sort of fine-tune people's Christian faith in church. But then the society began to shift, and Christendom began to go away. Society became a much more secular, less religiously reinforcing place. And so so the language that had been brought in to be countercultural in the 60s, the language of love and justice and celebration and community rather than the traditional language of God, began to not be as countercultural as it had been before, because the culture shifted away from being a Christian culture and was becoming a secular culture. And when the church had embraced secularity in the 60s, now all of a sudden the church was once again reflecting the values of the culture. So that was what was going on here. When I was in seminary in the 70s, friends would come over and check out Montclair. They'd heard about the creativity and the energy of this place, and would come back, and you know, it's when they were church shopping for a place to go to during seminary. And I remember one friend coming back and saying, "Well, they went a whole hour without ever once mentioning the word God, so I think I'll keep looking." So there was that, you know, how does the language continue to evolve to reflect a countercultural stance toward society? And I remember my sense of understanding the tradition, the non-traditional tradition of this church, was after I'd been the pastor here for a couple of years. I don't remember the exact timing, but there was a retreat, a day-long retreat for the members of session and the committee chairs and coordinators. And we were talking about doing some kind of congregational self-evaluation, and we're looking at some survey instruments to use and deciding if they fit well enough with who we are, were at that moment, to be useful. And they had a bunch of statements that had to do with understanding people's experience of the church, and it was kind of 1 to 5, agree, disagree, somewhat agree, and just statements. And one of them was, people freely share the good news of God's love with each other. In this congregation, people freely share the good news of God's love with each other. Agree, disagree, kind of agree. And someone said, that would be a good question to put before people if we took out the word God. People freely share the good news of love with each other. Okay. And I said, why is that? You know, why would you remove the word God? And this person, it was a great enlightening moment for me, said, well, you know, I don't believe there's some white bearded man up in the sky passing judgment on people. So I said, okay, who around this table believes in that God? And no hands went up. It's like, okay, we need to expand our definition of God, our understanding of who and what God is. And then some great conversation got going around the table then. One person talked about her experience of growing up in the church, being dissatisfied with traditional language and traditional Christian sort of practice in that church, exploring Eastern religions and Native American religions and getting some new understanding and new look into the spiritual life and spiritual realities, and then coming back into the church and being able to apply that to her understanding of God in the Christian tradition, and then reclaiming that, but in a new way, a new sense of the definition of the reality of God that got away from the white-haired guy in the clouds passing judgment on people. And another person said, you know, We've sort of thrown this God language out and have been doing without it for a long time. And what he said was, maybe it's time for us to get over it, which was sort of a shocking thing to hear. But someone said, you know, if we'd been struggling with other modes of things from our childhood that messed us up, we would have gone to a therapist and worked our way through. So if we got messed up by bad theology when we were 7 in Sunday school, maybe it's time for us to work that through, rather than just putting that into a box and locking it shut. So then we went into this wonderful process in the life of this church of finding ways to reintegrate God and the language of God and theology into the life of this church, to move past the repressive theologies of the past to something liberating, where God is understood as the source of that liberation rather than the source of the repression. We re-entered the Bible. We reclaimed the stories of God as the God of justice for the poor and oppressed, as the God of inclusion for the marginalized, as the God who gives voice to the voiceless, of the God of hospitality and welcome for all, and claim those stories as our own. And it's been a wonderful conversation, a process of reintegrating God consciously and intentionally into our communal life. And that was important in part because as the years went on and society became more secular, the next generation started coming in these doors with this post-Christendom experience of life, and were checking us out in the midst of that cultural shift, and weren't coming from an experience of bad theology or a bad church. They were coming from an experience of no theology and no church. So we didn't need to be apologizing anymore for bad theology. It was just, let's come and find out how to be a cultural church in the midst of this culture, a culture that was shifting in an extreme way toward this new American religion of consumerism and greed and the commodification of everything. So people were really looking for some God that could stand counter to that God of the culture. So we're still a countercultural church. But now that countercultural stance is accomplished more by embracing religious and theological language in an intentional and educated and careful way, embracing the language of God rather than rejecting it. So I asked myself the question, thinking about this morning, what would I want to say about God at this point in time and this point in my relationship with you after these years that we have spent together exploring ways of talking about God? So in the 3 minutes that I've got left, I just wanted to say a few words about the nature of God. There's a common attitude, when you look at the Bible, there's a common attitude toward the God of the Bible, which is to say that the Old Testament God is a God of judgment and the New Testament God is the God of love or mercy or grace, however you want to define it, with the implication being that the New Testament God is better. We're glad we get the New Testament God. But my sense is that we need both of those images integrated well to have an understanding of God that is actually life-transforming. The Psalm 82 that Tom read is a very ancient psalm. The images and the worldview in it come from a very ancient time where God, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is part of this whole council, heavenly council of all of these gods, the gods of all the other peoples and nations. And they all meet together and talk things over, I guess. It never goes into a lot of detail about what it is that they discuss. But at this particular moment, the story that is told in this psalm is that God takes God's place in this divine council of the other gods and holds judgment and announces or questions the integrity of the other gods by saying, "How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked, you other gods? How long will you be partial to the people who are wicked rather than partial to justice? Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy and deliver them from the hand of the wicked." So that is the judgment that the God, this judging God, pronounces on the world and on the powers and principalities of the world. And that is what the God of judgment is all about, Old Testament or New Testament, that the judge, this judge, is not being judgmental in that sort of picky way of judging us for all of our little private personal failings, but pronouncing judgment on humanity's failure to do justice to the poor and marginalized. That is the message of justice, of the God of judgment in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And as we have talked about a little bit over these last few weeks, the idea that all religious language is metaphorical, when you read this psalm about these gods, you can look at it as a metaphor for our own lives, this council of gods, God taking God's place within all of the other gods. And I see in that the other gods not being gods of other nations, but all of the other things we worship, all of the other gods that we allow to take the place of God in our lives as a society and as individuals, these little gods of power and comfort and security and complacency, it's referred to as idolatry in the traditional language, these little idols that keep us distracted from God's call for us to do the work of justice and peace in our lives, individually, church, and out there in the world. So that's the first thing that I want to say about God is, yeah, God is a God of judgment, but is not judgmental, and that sometimes we need that clear light of God's judgment trained on our lives in order to see clearly our responsibility for the poor and the marginalized. It's not there to make us feel guilty or disempowered, but to give us the clarity of purpose that God calls us to in the Old Testament and the New. All religious language is metaphorical. And if you try to stand up here and talk about God, God is the biggest metaphor of all, the most impossible to define. So we use these images, trying to make the reality of God accessible to us in some way. Referring to God as the judge. That says something about God's nature and God's relationship to us. That old metaphor of the great white father in the sky, that was trying to say something about God and about society that maybe we've moved on from. The metaphor of God as the shepherd tending to the flock, caring for the flock's safety and needs. The woman making bread and mixing the yeast in that leavens everything. The sower casting seeds. All of those are facets of the nature of God, attempts to describe the indescribable. I remember when I was first getting involved in church, and we had this little discussion group with the pastor, and he was talking to us about, you know, what is God, and trying to get away from this over-personification of God. And he was talking about something. I don't remember his exact words, but it was about God being the force in the universe that gives a positive valence to things. This was in Livermore, so there were a lot of scientists in the room. But that idea of that in the universe that makes things good, that was his attempt at a definition of God. A bit heady, but it points toward that experience of goodness in life and in nature and in our relationships. There is something good at the heart of all of this, which we refer to as God. I talked about my brother's cancer treatment. He gets these two different chemo treatments. One is these three drugs mixed together, and one is this really nasty, ferocious drug called Irino, is the short word for it. I don't remember the whole word. But there's the VAC and the Irino. And when we're looking at this scan showing how much the tumor had shrunk, Charlie said to the doctor, "So was it the VAC or the Irino that shrunk that tumor?" Obviously hoping he would never have to do the Irino ever again. And the doctor said, "Both." And there was that moment where it's like, we really want to know what worked here. And in the blog that my other brother posts, he put this good news onto the blog, and many of the comments are offering ideas about what worked. It was the mojitos that Charlie had, you know, one Saturday before the MRI was done, or it was the dog tags that people are wearing all over the world with good wishes for Charlie, or it was the Christian prayers, or it was the pagan good vibes, or it was the skill of the doctors and the nurses, or it was the Irino, or it was the VAC. And I was reading those and I was thinking, I don't care at this point because it's all good. At the heart of it, there is that goodness, that positive valence in the universe. And even these nasty, poisonous things have something good about them that that we are affirming at this moment. And that goodness is what the parable of the sower is about that Tom read, that story from Mark, where the metaphor is God sowing these seeds just everywhere, just throwing them around, throwing them on the path, throwing them where the weeds are and the thorns and where the birds will eat them. And some goes on good soil and some goes other places. But there's this goodness that is going out abundantly. And Barbara Brown Taylor, who's a wonderful preacher, had done a sermon on this, and she said that her usual response when she reads that parable is to think that it's about her, it's about us. How do I make my life good soil so that the seeds that God throws my way will take deep root and will thrive and flourish and bring forth 30 and 60 and 100 times yield? So it's like, is this a call for me to improve my life? And she said, but it's called the parable of the sower, not the parable, like, of the dirt. She said, what if it's not about us at all, but about the sower? What if it is not about our own successes and failures and birds and rocks and thorns, but about the extravagance of a sower who does not seem to be fazed by such concerns, who flings seed everywhere, wastes it with holy abandon, who feeds the birds, whistles at the rocks, picks his way through the thorns, shouts hallelujah at the good soil, and just keeps on sowing, confident that there is enough seed to go around, that there is plenty, and that when the harvest comes at last, it will fill every barn in the neighborhood to the rafters. If this is really the parable of the sower and not the parable of the different kinds of ground, then it begins to sound quite new. The focus is not on us and our shortfalls, but on the generosity of our Maker, the prolific sower who does not obsess about the condition of the fields, who is not stingy with the seed, but who casts it everywhere, on good soil and bad, who is not cautious or judgmental or even very practical. And that's all that I want to say today about the nature of God, that God flings goodness everywhere. And we have the joyful task of noticing as it takes root and flourishes in our hearts and in our lives and in our relationships and in our church and in our world, and being thankful. Amen.